from PowerlineBlog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierengoff, and Stephen Hayward.
Well, hey, everybody. It's Steve Hayward for the Powerline Show, back for another of our episodic episodes. Today, I am just overcome with all the greatness that's going on. So much greatness, I'm getting tired of all the greatness. And by that, I mean the American Greatness website, or amgreatness.com. And I'm pleased today to have the whole senior leadership of American Greatness joining us for the podcast. We have got Chris Buskirk, the editor and publisher and creator of the site, Ben Boychuk, the managing editor, and Julie Ponzi, the senior editor, and one of my former classmates in graduate school back around the time of the Boer War. So welcome, Greatness crowd. And I think I want to start first with you, Chris Buskirk. This was largely your brainchild, I think. And I have confessed before that having been on one of the early conference calls you held with a number of people, I think Ben was there too. Mm-hmm. I was frankly skeptical that a new website would work and build an audience just because the field is crowded. You know, there's our friends at the Federalist who've done a terrific job. There's all the other sites that are out there in the world. And I am pleased to be able to say that I was completely wrong. And you guys have made a great success of it. And so, I think you should take a couple of victory laps, Chris, and also Julie and Ben. But I think, what's your secret sauce? What explains why it has caught on? And maybe say a little bit about what your editorial philosophy and outlook is.
Well, first of all, I mean, you were on that first, that really was the first call that we had back in, I guess it was June of 16, Steve. And I mean, American Greatness is nothing if not a team effort. There were, I'm trying to remember now, six or seven of us on that call. And I've got to tell you, I remember you were skeptical back then, but nonetheless, looking at what you guys have done at Powerline has really helped guide us. And for us, the watchword is quality. It always is. If you do things right, you know, it's a cliche to say it, but cream rises. You've got to be diligent, and it takes time. But there was a lot of attention back in the summer and fall of 16, so it was an opportune moment to try and launch something new. But there were a number of people who looked at what we were trying to do and said, yeah, is there really space? There were some other people who looked at what we were trying to do and said, actually, for what you're trying to do, what you in particular are trying to do is there is space. And you've got a great team there. You've got people who've known each other for many, many years, have been friends. And the team itself, I think, is really critical to the success of what we've done at American Greatness. Editorial philosophy, we're about making sure that we have the best, most thoughtful writers and being really timely, but staying on target, staying on point, talking about what our name says. What does it mean to be an American? What does it mean for this country to be not just okay, but exceptional, but great? And it doesn't matter what the topic is. Those are the principles that we stick with, and so far, so good.
Well, you know, one of the things I noticed is you've attracted some real, what you might otherwise call A-list writers like Victor Davis Hanson and Conrad Black and Michael Walsh, people who can write just about anywhere they want to, but they've chosen to write for you. And you've also discovered some people who are brand new to me, like Michelle Brigand. Maybe Julie can talk about her a little bit. And, you know, a few other writers, Brandon Weichert, a few other people who I think are maybe just starting out, you might say, and a new platform for Julie Kelly. Where did you find these people? Maybe I'll start with you, Julie Ponzi. Where did you find Michelle Brigand, or did she find you guys?
You know, this is the crazy thing about the way our site got started. Chris and I have known each other forever, but we hadn't been in contact for about 20 years. And then because we were somehow connected on Facebook and we discovered that we had similar inclinations regarding the election. And of course, both were fans of Michael Anton's Journal of American Greatness. When that went away, we were both sort of bemoaning the fact that it wasn't there anymore. And then we said, well, maybe we should just start our own thing. So that's sort of how the idea got started.
So there is something good that came out of Facebook.
This is correct. And within 48 hours, we sort of had a business plan and we were up and running. And a lot of our writers came to us because they were also on Facebook. We found Michelle because she was engaged in a debate with some friends. We weren't even connected to her as a friend, but she was engaged with a debate with some friends over the song, Baby, It's Cold Outside. And
oh, I remember that piece. That was such
that was her first piece. Right. She was just making such wonderful comments that I just sent off a note to her over Facebook and said, hey, you know, we have a lot of friends in common. Loved what you're saying. Would you be interested in writing an article about it? And that's how it got started. And several of our best writers have come to us exactly that way.
By the way, who is Michelle? I don't know anything about her. I mean, does she have a job? I mean, what's her background?
Michelle is an artist, and she is married to an English professor at University of Dallas, has a very good education in her own right. But yeah, she's an artist who works from home and a mom like me. Uh-huh.
Now, is it fair to say, and maybe Ben, you can start out with an answer to this question, but you can all take a whack at it. Is it fair to say that American greatness has gone all in for Trump? Is that a fair characterization? Is that a half an insult? I mean, how would you respond to that that description?
Well, you know, in our initial editorial statement, we put up a kind of a manifesto when we launched the site in 2016. Articulating a greatness agenda. And we can talk about that if you want. But in that editorial, we said we're essentially agnostic on the outcome of the election. So in other words, if Donald Trump had lost the election in 2016, we would not have closed shop. We didn't necessarily get into this because of Trump. I was a Trump skeptic up until the very end. We talked about this a couple shows ago. I was a Trump skeptic up until the weekend before the election, and then it became clear to me that, you know, I had to vote for him. But it was the agenda that he was articulating that had appealed to me, and it had appealed to me all along. I think that you know, one of the things that we're trying to do at American Greatness is make a lot of the arguments that you may not see at other sites that have been kind of vehemently anti-Trump, because there's plenty of anti-Trump material out there on the left and the right. I don't think we're doing hagiography. In fact, we reject a lot of pieces that come in like that. We're trying to focus on, though, we're trying to focus on things like, you know, an America First foreign policy and trade, and in particular immigration, which is a big deal right now. Those are the issues that we've kind of been trying to hammer, and I think that's kind of where our place in this universe is.
Let me follow up with Julie on this point a bit, and you know, pardon me for playing the gender card, right? I mean, Trump is supposed to be most unpopular with women, and yet you've written a number of pieces making the point, I think I'd characterize this way, that it takes someone of Trump's outrageous brashness, those are my terms, not yours, I think, to break through the maw of the administrative state and the political correctness that constricts public discourse. Respond to that characterization of your views, if I've got it close to right, or correct them as they should be corrected.
Well, I mean, I'm really, I guess, agnostic about Trump regarding his brashness and his somewhat unpopular persona, especially with women. All that I can say is that it's working. So, you right. know, I'm looking at the results and going, looks like it's working to me. So apparently we did need to. And what I do like about him is that he's raising questions and making people think. And, you know, whether it needs to be done the way that he's doing it, I can't answer that. I just know that he is doing it and that it's working for him.
Right.
Would there be a better way that some other kind of person could do it? Possibly. But so far, you know, I've been waiting for someone to come around and shake people out of their calcified thinking, especially on the right, for about 25 years, 30 years, or as long as I've been paying attention to American politics, and no one has done it in quite the way that he has done it.
Yeah, I mean, my two responses to you and Ben are that I remained a Trump skeptic until about 9:30 p.m. Eastern time on election night. I didn't think he could possibly win. And I remain worried because it's not clear what this person's real center of gravity is ideologically. I mean, we know he was pretty much a liberal Democrat for much of his life and thought about running as a Democrat for president as recently as 2004. On the other hand, as a thought experiment, I've been trying to imagine, would any of the other Republicans in the field have governed the way he has governed? Maybe Ted Cruz, had he won, although I think I agree with you, Julie, that he wouldn't have raised certain questions in quite the pointed way Trump has. But
Which is why he wouldn't have won.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's probably right. I mean, would Jeb Bush have withdrawn from the Paris Climate Accord or canceled the Clean Power Plan? Not in a million years, right?
Well, not only that, Steve, but Jeb Bush would have been terrible on immigration. His official position is open borders and amnesty. Which is why he couldn't win.
Right. Illegal immigration is an act of love, right? That was a pretty low point. So let's turn to that subject for a moment, actually, because that's what's in front of us. We've just had this government shut down, aborted by the Democrats very fast. I thought this was going to drag on a while, was my hunch about it. And the conventional wisdom, including amongst a lot of conservative observers, is that the Democrats folded. And maybe that's correct. But here's what worries me, and you guys sort this out for me and our listeners, is Trump wants the wall, and he may get it. I actually think the wall was less important than ending chain migration and the visa lottery and so forth. And you've even seen a few Democrats like Luis Gutierrez, who's a full amnesty person, say maybe we'll give him his wall if we keep all the other stuff, right? And, you know, if you believe that some of the press reports are accurate to one degree or another, Trump himself has been a little undecided as exactly what his bottom line is on an immigration deal. So I wonder if we shouldn't be worried that, in fact, game this out for me. How do you think this is going to unfold? What's your expectation?
It's hard to say what my expectation is, Steve, because like you, I'm extremely cautious about this because as conservatives and as immigration patriots, maybe that's a term we can use, we have been burned every single time that this issue has come up since 1965. Right, so there is no way not to be extremely cautious and skeptical until you see what is passed and how it's implemented. Right, so you may raise an interesting point: which is more important? If you could only have one, end chain migration or build the wall? Well, my position on that is I won't take only one. Right, it's got to be all of the above. The Goodlatte bill, which has been circulating now for about a week and a half. I think, or maybe it's 2 weeks now, but I think that is the bill. That is the model, which says, okay, you want to do something about DACA? We can do something about DACA, but build the wall, end chain migration, end the visa lottery, and implement E-Verify. That is a very fair deal. What that exposes, though, the fact that Democrats haven't jumped all over this, what it exposes is that they really don't care about DACA. They think this is a political issue that they could use to gin up their base in November. And it also exposes the fact that the only way they think that they have a party in the future is by importing voters.
Right. And, one of my suspicions is that the Democrats don't really want an immigration deal. They would rather have an issue to run on forever.
I think that's right. Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
It is extreme. It's cynical, but they think it's effective. I'm not sure it is, but it is up to Republicans, conservatives, anybody who cares about sovereignty and citizenship to expose them on exactly that point, because they gin up these crowds of people who are here illegally, or maybe who are sympathetic to people who are here illegally, who think that the Democrats are on their side. They're not. They're using them. The Democrats have a plantation mentality on everybody they come into contact with. And, it's a cynical ploy, but it's up to us to make sure that more people understand that.
So your term immigration patriotism prompts a thought that I think would be perfect for American greatness to take up. There's one thing missing, I think, from Trump's handling of this issue, and it goes back to the immigration bill that Ronald Reagan signed in 1986. And by the way, if you talk to Ed Meese, who of course is still with us, he says, yeah, we got had on that deal. You know, we were promised enforcement. It didn't happen in return for amnesty. We wouldn't make that deal again. It was a mistake. However, one of the things I remember from that cycle of immigration reform is the way Ronald Reagan talked about immigration, right? You may remember this, Chris. I know Bill Bennett and I used to talk about this speech he gave a lot where Reagan talked about how, you know, you can move to France or move to Germany, but you can't become a Frenchman or a German. He says, I mean, you can get legal citizenship, but you can't really become a real French person or German, right? You can, anyone can become an American. How do you become an American? By adopting our principles. I think he even may have referenced a Declaration of Independence. In other words, he was making a straightforward argument in favor of assimilation, the old-fashioned way. And of course, assimilation now is a dirty word. If you say that, you're a racist. And that was, you know, the whole idea of assimilation was notably missing 10 years ago when George W. Bush and John McCain attempted immigration reform. And I think that Republicans ought to be pushing that as a major idea. You know, there's no legal term for it, but you put it in the legislative language and just watch the left go bananas over it.
Steve, here's the problem with that. Okay, what does that mean anymore, assimilation? Part of the problem is that we aren't even doing a good job of assimilating people who are born in the country.
Right.
What people don't know, what does it mean to be an American? I think we have to have that conversation first. And before we start thinking about assimilating more immigrants, we have to start talking about how we're going to assimilate ourselves to our own ideas and principles. I mean, part of the problem is that we've simply lost our own way.
Well, you know, you make a good point. I mean, I think that you can argue that many immigrants who come to this country actually have a better grasp of the essence of America than native-born Americans these days, right? I mean, that is a good counterpoint.
Absolutely, some do, because they're still, you know, looking at the old ways, looking at the old books, looking at the old documents, and understanding what they mean apart from all of the layers and layers of crappy lead paint we've put over top of it. So sure.
Right. Right, right. Well, I still think it'd be fun to cause – I mean, by the way, I've talked to Mark Krikorian about that's the same idea about assimilation, and he agrees with you, by the way. He thinks it's a not a fool's errand, but that I am too optimistic and hopeful in thinking that
an argument can be made that the immigrants we're getting today are assimilating. They're assimilating to our nonsense ideas about multiculturalism, the America-hating – civics lessons that our kids are learning in school. I mean, this is the standard line today. So look, until we defeat the foreign ideology of the left, the un-American ideology of the left, there is no assimilation that's meaningful.
Yeah. By the way, my crazy idea on this is, you remember how Franklin Roosevelt in his first or second day in office declared a bank holiday to stop a run on the banks, right?
And yep. Prevent.
I've been musing with the idea that President Trump ought to declare a university holiday. Just declare the whole university has to be closed down for a week or 2 weeks until we can, to quote his other line, figure out what's going on.
That's right.
Well, yeah, there's an argument, you know, in that same vein, Steve, there's an argument for an immigration holiday, right? After the last great wave of immigration from 1880 to 1924-25, you know, after that, the Congress effectively closed the border. I mean, there was not no immigration after that, but there was minimal. It was severely restricted, and that gave Americans about 40 years from 1925 to 1965 to become Americans. And it reduced the amount of pressure that was being placed on the politics and the culture by wave after wave of people coming from abroad. It gave people time to pause and catch their breath and digest. And that, you know, we probably need that again. We've had a 50-year run of a massive immigration wave. And I think it's only common sense, even for people who are in favor of larger, in favor of more immigration, it's only common sense that you have to pause at some point. Otherwise, your society becomes fragmented.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. All right, let's turn back to Trump a little bit more. You know, his poll numbers are actually edging up a little bit. He's over 40% in the latest. What's that? You say I'm surprised?
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. No, right.
You know, he's catching flack, which is what he's supposed to be doing.
Right. There's a poll out the other day. I wrote about this on Powerline. A poll out the other day where Trump's numbers, they were odd. His numbers on individual issues, some of them held up pretty well, like the economy and foreign policy. They're not over 50%, but they were mid to high 40s. And guess what? Those are the two most important issues to most Americans these days. And then second, there was a general question. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the United States for the next 3 years while Trump is president? So you know, Trump's name was brought up in connection with that question, and 50% said they were optimistic. And I think the pessimistic was 45, 46 with 4% undecided. But there was Trump sitting at 50% on a very general question that wasn't connected to his personality and his tweets and all the rest of that. I thought, well, that's an interesting thing. But I asked Ben this question. I want to ask you, Julie and Chris, what could go wrong? What worries you in the back of your mind about either Trump directly or indirectly, just the circumstances and events that could come along and trip everything up?
I worry about Republicans being Republicans.
Well, you're right. The stupid party's not known for that for nothing, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, you know, Julie Kelly had a great piece up at our site yesterday about the title of it is "Forget Coattails, GOP Needs Trump's Backbone in 2018." I mean, that's kind of it. When the Republicans find that they do have spines buried underneath of all of that mushy cartilage, they do okay. It works if you stand up for what you allege that you believe, and don't cater to the donor class that is funding your campaigns instead of the people who you're allegedly representing. So they do a good job when they need to. So yeah. I would like to see maybe they'll learn that when they stand up for the issues that the American people said they wanted in this election. I mean, yes, okay, fine. Trump didn't get the majority of votes in 2016, but he won the election according to the rules of our Constitution, which is something that no other Republican would have been able to do.
Yeah. So, by the way, I want to come back to that vote question for a minute, but I want to get Chris's answer about what worries him or what keeps you awake at night.
Well, immigration, of course, I think that's the signal issue of the day. If you lose that issue, you lose everything else. So that is a big one. But it's underlying that is what Julie said, which is Republicans being Republicans. I mean, you know, it's my considered opinion that most Republicans don't believe much of anything. And I'm not talking about rank and file. I'm talking about the Republicans, the elected Republicans in the House and Senate. There's maybe a third of them that I think are very solid, but there's a bunch of them that are just they're conservative by temperament, not by ideology. And,
they like being elected officials. Right.
Yeah. Let's go back to that vote count for thing for a moment that you brought up, Julie, and in particular because you and Ben, like myself, are inmates of the formerly golden state of California. I don't care about that vote count because Hillary got all of her vote margin from here in California, and California is completely insane. Trump wins handily in the other 49 states, right? I think that's correct.
That's correct.
If you take out New York, it's certainly true, right? So,
yeah.
So just for a moment, I mean, I was actually talking to I won't name him, but a very famous never Trumper on the phone earlier today. And based on the East Coast, and was saying, California, I've spent my whole life here. It's really astonishing how low the state has fallen. Whether you want to look at the poverty rate, these homeless camps that now go on for miles along the Santa Ana River,
Hooverville.
There, you've seen that shocking video,
yes.
Right? And I don't know. I mean, we could go on all day. I don't want to go on too long about this, but let's just lament our poor state for a moment and say, is there any hope for California?
Well. Let me chime in here because
it's a word that rhymes with no.
Well, yeah, spoken like an Arizonan, and I wanted to jump in before Julie added her pessimistic take because she's from Ohio, for God's sake.
True.
Is there hope for the state? I think there is. I just don't know if it happens in our lifetimes. And I'm a much younger man than you are, Steve. So,
yeah, but you're just as bald as I am. So there.
The trajectory is bad, and we will find ourselves as we have found ourselves over the past 7 years, sort of gawking in wonder at Jerry Brown being the adult in Sacramento, is he being the one who has kind of held back the tide of total progressive insanity. And And really, it's, of course, yeah, he hasn't.
I just felt a shiver run down my spine, Ben, just at that.
No, Ben is right. I mean, people are shocked when I tell them that, believe it or not, Jerry Brown is the only thing standing between us and total insanity. And that, you know, how can this – that shows you how bad things are, right?
It really does. And so we're going to have a gubernatorial election this year that nobody's really talking about too much yet. They're you know, and it's going to be because we have this idiotic Republican-made top two primary system. Because of that, we're not going to have any Republicans in the general election. It's going to be a battle between two Democrats, most likely. And it's going to be a battle between someone who will present himself, Gavin Newsom, as a somewhat business-friendly Democrat, and then a leftist. And that's what will, you know, that's going to be the choice. And so, you know, yeah.
I've been saying for months now that maybe California is so far gone that it deserves a governor named Gavin. but you know, the leftist you describe, I think, Ben, you mean Antonio Villaraigosa, the former mayor of Los Angeles?
He seems to be one of the front runners. It could be him.
Yeah, you know, on the other hand, he's taken to attacking Tesla Democrats in the Bay Area, which I kind of like, right? That's sort of the worst of progressive elitism of the Bay Area, which now dominates of California politics. The Democratic Party is now Bay Area dominated, whereas it used to be L.A. was the counterweight. It's not really anymore.
Sure.
Julie, do you want to get in on this fun party celebrating the demise of our state?
It could be sort of fun to watch them eat each other. I mean,
look, I'm in Arizona.
It's probably what we're going to have to settle for. Yeah, well,
yeah, that's right.
I'm looking to move to Arizona, as a matter of fact.
Well, that would be good. I mean, one of the worries is too many Californians leave and they take California values with them and wreck other states. You hear that from other states.
Yeah, I know.
All right, let's do one last topic and then we'll get out for today. Shifting gears completely, do you guys have any summary judgments on the rise and fall of Steve Bannon? Were you guys ever sort of friendly with Bannon or supportive of him or aligned with him or you know, how do you come out now on where
I'd like to comment on that
Bannon?
Just first, if you don't mind, you know, Bannon was, I was quite friendly with him and continue to be on a personal level. And you know, that does not mean that I in any way countenance the idea of letting Michael Wolff into the West Wing, which I think is an extraordinarily bad idea. You know, here's my basic takeaway from that is I like Steve a lot personally, and I wish him nothing but the best. But it is his story, I think, is a cautionary tale for anybody who wants to serve any president, which is that you're just never bigger than the person in the Oval Office. And you need to, if you want to take a job like that, you need to be there to serve that person. If you can't do it, leave. But any other ambitions that you have need to be subsumed with underneath the idea that you are there to be an agent of the person who is elected by the American people.
Yeah, sound counsel. Julie or Ben, either one of you have a thought on Bannon?
Yeah, I don't personally know him, so my sentiments echo those of Chris, just that we didn't elect Steve Bannon, we elected Donald Trump.
Yeah. I agree with that.
Right. Okay. Well, I think with that, I will let you guys get back to creating more greatness. And I'll send you away with the Powerline Show's new sign-off line, which you will all recognize and I think we should keep alive as long as possible. And it is, be sure not to forget to milk the soft power dividend.
I like it. That fits on a bumper sticker, but just barely.
That's right. Okay, bye, guys. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.